Marion. Instead, we have a young, dynamic replacement in Ron Cook, our first star reserve. And the subject this afternoon is, has the modern market superseded Marxian economics? It will follow exactly the same format as the other meetings, except that if you wish to place questions, come and see me with the usual garnish beforehand.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Yeah, I think I'll probably be a bit shorter than some of the previous speakers as well. We're a bit shorter of time for a start off. I'm not quite sure what the drafter of the question for this title really meant by it. However, I'm trying to see what... It says the word superseded gives me the problems. How can the market supersede economics? You know, they seem to be in slightly different parts of reality. But if I start, when I started thinking about the economic situation, of course, we've all seen the papers recently about the trouble with the Southeast Asian tigers. You know, these economies, Indonesia, Malaysia, probably China itself, and so on. It's fascinating reading, isn't it? And many people are not old enough to have lived through a really big slump, and it would be more fascinating for those, for people who have seen a slump in the past. It's a wearisome and slightly frightened, oh no, but not again, you know, still. Because already the toll on the working class out in Southeast Asia has been quite terrible. Equally, the fortunes made by some of the more fortunate capitalists, like Suharto and his family in Indonesia, have been enormous, into the billions. Now, these tigers, as they've been nicknamed, these Southeast Asian economies, which included ones like Taiwan, of course, and I suppose, even though it's not Southeast, Japan itself, they were models of what one might call capitalist excellence for the Thatcher governments, for the major governments. They were energetic, they were enterprising, they were extremely profitable, which is the most thing, most important thing. And the tame economists, and we've been talking about the prostitution or the fetishization of intellectual pursuits, the tame economists and the financial journalists in particular thought that they were a model for this economy and for any other economy. That was the way to run capitalism. Well, now it's all gone sour. The bubbles burst, to coin a phrase which was applied to a capitalist venture back in the 18th century. And inevitably, though not necessarily rapidly, the results of their economic recession are going to be felt all around the world. There are at the moment saying that British manufacturing is starting to shed workers, and it's partly because those Southeast Asian economies selling the same sorts of things are reducing their prices like mad to try and stay in the race. So these economists, to a large extent, got it wrong. Ah, they say, but what we didn't know is that there'd been massive corruption, there'd been false accounting. Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? They're blaming the slump on corruption, not on capitalism itself. That's especially interesting for those of us who are radically critical of capitalism. Because these same champions of capitalism have always boasted that this politico-economic system is really the only one, this is why it's been called by Fukuyama the end of history, it's the one which really suits human nature. It's a natural system, it's basic, it's what everything would revert to, they say, if we try to bring in socialism. Now they're saying it won't work if people are corrupt, and if people are inefficient, dishonest. And it's a rather poor piece of apologetics, isn't it, from them? They can't think of much better things to say. And I suppose we shouldn't be surprised, because if we look at what these so-called academically respectable economists have written over the past 10 years, we can see that they've trotted out some very absurd as well as some very weak ideas. Behind every avowed attempt at analysis of capitalism, explication of what's been going on, has been the implicit assumption that it's a system which is fully viable, inherently stable, healthy, and progressive. In fact, these are the same sorts of people, the same sorts of writers that Marx labelled vulgar economists. In another context, he called them the hired prize fighters of capitalism. In fact, their academic respectability is about as respectable as a transparent pair of trousers. Their main function has been to justify the workings of capitalism, to try and confer respectability upon its social effects and its institutions, and to concoct excuses for its more blatant inadequacies. Insofar as they do discover or explain anything useful or new about either the microeconomics or the macroeconomics of the system, there is one objective only, and that's in order to try and obtain and pass on some sort of control of the economy, some sort of control about what happens in what is really a roller coaster ride. In other words, they work in the service of the owning class, of the capitalist class, and they work in the service of their investing agencies, their organizational agencies, their governments, other financial power groups such as IMF and the World Bank and so on. These are the people who really need to know about what sort of input can we make. Did you see recently the assumption, I've forgotten which Southeast Asian government spokesman is expecting, not hoping, not pleading, expecting President Clinton in his trip to the Far East is going to come up with a solution to their problem. I mean, it really, people listen to it on the news and don't bat an eyelid, but it really is like asking the good fairy to come and wave a magic wand. What can President Clinton do about it? Well, he might say pour in money. That's probably what they say, because they think it's all a bit of an instability in the financial markets. Well, I won't go into it in too much detail, but we've seen this done before. We've seen the Japanese government doing it to the tune of billions of dollars, and it hasn't done the trick. Now, President Clinton's got to say to himself, even if he were in a position to do this, which he's not, he'd have to say to himself, is the American capitalist class going to dole out all this money to save these people? You know, it's a ludicrous thing. And it's all happened in the past. As Marxists, I mean, we've had two historians speaking to us so far. You know, we've had Sir Steve and we've had Adam telling us about the history of capitalism. And anybody who looks at the history of capitalism will see that it has never been free of slumps. It has rarely been free of stagnation of one sort or another. And they have never been able to cure it. They've blamed sunspots, they've blamed everything for it. Anything but blame capitalism. But it's happened with such persistent regularity, not actually the same periods every time, but it's with sheer certainty that it always will happen in capitalism. Now, what I'm supposed to do is compare this with, or what's going on with what Marx said. Well, Marx, first of all, contended that efforts like theirs, efforts like their demanding of President Clinton, were absolutely futile. Capitalism is anarchic, it is secretive, and what's more, it's infinitely complex and spread right over the world. And capital, Marx insisted, is unpredictable, therefore, it's uncontrollable, and the only thing it's accountable to is the maximization of profit. Nothing else drives it. Indeed, he maintained that even if the rate of profit at any one time, even the rate of profit at any one time is an unknowable magnitude. Now, it would seem that that's pretty obvious if you're in the investment business. But because of the evening out achieved through stock markets, this is really unknowable. In other words, they do not know. They might suspect when they're getting towards a crisis, when the slump is about to start, but they don't know. They never know. And they come up with all sorts of nostrums. It's at the time when people are most confident that it's going to happen. Well, that's nonsense. People can be confident at all sorts of times. Nevertheless, it just emphasizes the fact that they do not know. What they're saying is when you most think you do know, but that you don't know, and they're no more intelligent simply because they're saying a nonsense. Marx wrote this sort of thing back in the 1850s and 60s, and it has happened precisely this way ever since. They didn't know then, and they don't know now. These are experts who have been studying this who have had some of the most massive research grants that there are, who've had so many think tanks that they must be running out of water for them. These are the people who are supposed to have come up with the answers 100 years, over 100 years, and yet they still have no answer to what is happening. They can't predict which way the markets are going to go, and really, it surprises me that the capitalist class goes on employing them. If you have a panel of them, which the previous government did, I think this one may have maintained it, they come up with usually a distribution of answers to the problem which completely even one another out, so they're no answer at all. However, it makes the population, the working class, think that something is being done about it. In fact, they don't do anything about it. Now, Marx's investigation of capitalism has a completely different approach. Marx saw the increasing pauperization of peasants across Europe taking place as capitalism started ousting feudalism. When he came to England, he saw the herding together of untold thousands of undernourished, unhealthy men, women and children into the mines and mills and factories and machine shops of the expanding industrial revolution. Places like this just up the road. And he set about examining the fundamental workings of capitalism so that he could expose the causes of these miseries to view. He insisted, however, that this type of analysis was a little, if any, use to those whose purpose was to invest and make profits. It was a totally different sort of economics. Instead of supporting, bolstering up, apologising for the effects of capitalism, Marx was analysing and examining it in order to criticise and expose the weaknesses and the culpabilities of the system. He wanted to provide intellectual weapons for a revolutionary working class, which would, he hoped, jettison capitalism entirely. Jettison it in favour of a world society based upon meeting the needs of its whole people. Such a world society he and Engels at different times called socialism or communism to mean the same thing. Well, the working class has not yet done what Marx, Engels, and William Morris and many other socialists hoped they would. Capitalism has grown and developed scientifically and technologically, and it's spread more widely around the world, just as Marx predicted. The massive profit made across the world from the exploitation of working men, women and children today beggars the millions that made in Marx's day into insignificance. They are billions and trillions today. The wealth produced is vast, and the possibility for plenty for everyone is painfully obvious. It's obvious with every cut in farmers' prices, every piece of set-aside land, every subsidised meat and butter and wheat mountain that's built up. It's also obvious this week, or was it last week now? Yes, because when I wrote it last week, when OPEC decided that we're going to cut back oil production because they weren't getting the price they wanted, and therefore they were going to make it artificially scarce. And it's there with the overproduction of memory chips for computers, and it's there with the overproduction of motor cars. You can judge by the amount, so a prodigious amount of motor car advertising that's going on, but there is a real crisis in the world's motor car industry. It's there in the production of white goods, fridges and washing machines and so on. There is overproduction of virtually everything you can think of that is a commodity. Not overproduction necessarily of everything that people want, over everything that can be sold at profit or could be while the boom was lasting. What has not changed, in spite of all that development, is the poverty, the starvation, and the millions of deaths through malnutrition and squalid living conditions. Millions every year. This pauperisation of the new working class, and I'm talking about new here when I'm talking about Southeast Asia, those areas of the world, South America, Africa and so on. That's taking place everywhere where capitalism is spread around the globe. And this capitalism makes no progress except to expand the area and the scale of its effects. Now, there are those who say that Marx was entirely wrong to predict that capitalism would produce increasing misery. Looking at Europe and North America, they claim that this social system has brought increased living standards. The trouble is that their view is too restricted. They forget to take in Mexico City, Mexico in general. They forget to take in Haiti, someone was referring to the actual wages that Disney pays for the production of its dolls in Haiti. They forget to take in the rest of South America. They forget to take in Malaysia, Indonesia, Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, Japan, Korea, India, Pakistan, and many, many parts of Africa, and so on and so on. These countries still have Victorian oppression, they still have Victorian exploitation, they still have Victorian squalor and disease. These living conditions, now magnified in numbers, prodigiously over what Britain was like, are the same sort of misery that was there in Marx's time. And the world's investors did very nicely out of it all. So much so that large sectors of Western, so-called Western industry, have moved out to China and Southeast Asia. A number of firms from the Birmingham and the Black Country, say Albright and Wilson, the great big chemical firm, now have a chemical firm in factory in Taiwan, they have one in Indonesia, they have one in Malaysia, and they have one in China. And they're thinking whether they're going to bother to keep on the one in Old Regis down the road, because they're doing so much better out there, their wages are lower. Means that millions more workers than in Marx's day are being used as industrial fodder to be thrown aside when their energy has been sucked dry or the market no longer needs their efforts. And at the same time, the land and the seas and the minerals lying underneath both of them are being pillaged and wasted in an orgy of consumerism in order to yield ever greater profits. Another thing that's not changed is the cycle of booms and slumps, as I said at the beginning. As I was writing this, the Japanese economy, pivotal for Eastern Asia, was sliding into collapse. There is one financial disaster after another. This feature of social life, that's been called sometimes the trade cycle, I would prefer to call it the capital cycle myself, but it is peculiar to the capitalist politico-economic system. It's occurred with distressing inevitability ever since capitalism began. Despite a countless futile attempts to understand this phenomenon of recession or depression or slump, you can tell they're cheating when they use so many damn words to mean the same thing. They keep on renaming it, like they do with Sellafield. It ruins so many livelihoods and it costs so many lives. None of the economics professors or government advisors has devised a plan which has ameliorated, let alone prevented, this inbuilt feature of capitalism. But some capitalist economists have just begun to glimpse a trace of the reality by moving towards Marx's analysis of the system. Dick sent me a copy of last October's New Yorker. Some other people may have seen it. A journalist in there named John Cassidy wrote this. Early this summer, I enjoyed a weekend at the Long Island vacation home of a college friend, a highly intelligent and level-headed Englishman whose career has taken him, by way of the upper echelons of the British civil service and a financial firm in the city of London, to a big Wall Street investment bank. There he spent the last few years organising stock issues and helping his firm milk, I love the metaphor, milk the strongest market in living memory. Between dips in his pool, we discussed the economy and speculated about how long the current financial boom would last. To my surprise, he brought up Karl Marx. The longer I spend on Wall Street, the more convinced I am that Marx was right, he said. I assumed he was joking. There's a Nobel Prize waiting for the economist who resurrects Marx and puts it all together in a coherent model, he continued quite seriously. I'm absolutely convinced that Marx's approach is the best way to look at capitalism. Instead, therefore, of becoming progressively out of date as capitalism expands and progresses, Marx's work increasingly shows itself as forward-looking, prophetic. Now, why should this be so? Why should his examination of capitalism be so different from all the economists, like Keynes, Galbraith and so on, who've got it wrong? Marx's attempt was to show, to lay bare the anatomy and the physiology of capitalism, to show not only how it worked, not only how it works, because it is the most important point I'm going to make, but how it must work. It inevitably must work, given its class exploitative structure. Once you've given that, all the rest follows. What Marx's analysis shows is that however powerful, sophisticated, labour-saving, energy-efficient the production processes and the commodities which emerge from it are, capitalism is bound to keep its workers perpetually on the edge of poverty, mainly because if it didn't, they could break free. Of course, also because the competition between them all forces everyone to screw the screw down a bit tighter and increase the profit margin a little bit greater. All the pressures insist that workers shall never be paid a living wage, a good wage. They shall never have reasonable housing and so on. Not in the main. There may be isolated pockets here and there, but in the main this cannot happen to the working class under capitalism. Now that's just not a bitter opinion of mine. It's not even an opinion of socialists in general. It's an objective politico-economic fact. It's the basis upon which capitalism continues to exist and operate. This state of affairs, however, is not simply economic. I'll put it in inverted commas to make me say it this way. In fact, as I've repeatedly hinted, there is no such thing as pure economics. And the people who say that that's what they're studying are fooling themselves or fooling us or both. The real situation is of a particular pattern of life and work imposed upon society by a dominant class. In other words, it is a politico-economic system. The fascinating thing is that this way of life is accepted by millions of human beings, not as a regime imposed upon them by other human beings, but as reality. The real world. Get real. That's life. And so on. There are all these phrases to try and say, you must look at it this way, you must keep looking at it this way. The working class is trying to say, there isn't anything else around there. We mustn't believe there is something else out there. And this is, of course, what capitalism tries to get them to think and say. Of course, the fact is that this is not life. It's not naked and unadorned reality. It's just a regime, like an African dictatorship, or an Amish cult, or a Ku Klux Klan vendetta, for that matter. They're all regimes. They're exercises of power of one section of society over another. And Marx showed how it was imposed, to the workers, to the political machine and so on, and how it's maintained. Now this is the key to his success in analysing its workings and explaining its peculiar features, such as crises and slumps. One feature of the workings of the capitalist system, which Marx analysed in great detail in Volume 3 of Capital, was the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. I can hear Dave Perrin using this term. He may not talk about it in quite the same way as I would, but we're both interested in it. Marx pointed to the increase in mechanisation which capitalists employed to get more and better machinery. I'm sorry, I'm skipping lines. To get more and more production out of each worker. Employ more and more machinery to get more and more production out of each worker. The consequences of that are this, that capitalists are forced to reinvest the bulk of their profits as new capital into buying more and better machinery. When I first became a socialist, I believed that capitalists simply lived off their interest and profit, and that was the prime purpose of their investment, and that they were rather like sheikhs or sultans or even feudal lords, simply living off workers. Not so. That's not the driving force in capitalism. The driving force, and they are driven too, is reinvestment. Capital must make that circuit back round again. New profits must become new capital to be reinvested round and round and round in this spiral. On page 208 of the Moscow edition of Capital, volume 3, Marx writes, this mode of production, that's the capitalist mode, produces a progressive relative decrease of the variable capital, that's wages, compared to the constant capital, that's premises and plants and machinery and so on. And consequently, a continuously rising organic composition of the total capital. The immediate result of this is the rate of surplus value at the same time, or even a rising degree of labour exploitation, is represented by a continually falling general rate of profit. This corresponds, he said, to a progressive cheapening of products. Well, does it? Well, the picture is obscured by inflation. But in fact, if we were to take any common object like a car, we could see that it now costs a smaller fraction of the average worker's annual wage than it used to do. It is a cheaper product. Take personal computers, which I've mentioned once or twice in the bits in. Look at what's happened to the price of computers. They'll still clock the same figures in their adverts on daily Sunday newspapers. They still want a little bit over, and perhaps a great deal over, £1,000 off you for a computer. But you can now buy reasonable specification personal computers for about £300 or £400, whereas you could not get them for anything under £1,200 3 or 4 years ago. Price drop in computers is extremely rapid and therefore quite visible. Nevertheless, Marx goes to a great deal of trouble in Volume 3 to demonstrate that this basic tendency of the rate of profit to fall in capitalist production is in practice usually offset by countervailing forces. In particular, there are a number of forces that he refers to, but it's the main one and the most consistently effective one is the speed of technological development. If the rate of extraction of surplus value from the workers escalates at a greater rate than the fall in the rate of profit, one force moving faster than another, then the rate of profit can actually continue to rise. And in our actual experience, for much of the 20th century, this has been so. It's particularly so over this most recent development in capitalism, which I may be illegitimate in calling it a revolution, but I really do think it justifies it, the Silicon Revolution, the introduction, the development of computers. Now, when we discuss this question of the rate of profit and the increase in the rates, you know, it becomes, we're talking about accelerations now, we are talking about huge figures. We're talking about billions of money, and they're quite difficult to calculate and quite difficult to discover in many cases. For much of this century, the actual outstripping of the fall in the rate of profit by technological development hasn't been tremendously possible. It certainly wasn't possible during the 30s. And this is one of the effects of a capitalist trade cycle, that if you get a slump and you get stagnation, then investment tends to stop, and so technological development tends to stop. Nevertheless, all that has changed for the time being. It's a longish period, but it has changed. And where has the change come from? The impetus for the change, really, as I think we shall all see, came from World War II. It's taken some time to gather speed, much of it, but that's what happens. Many technological developments, some would say most, occur because of war. It is a hothouse of technological development, not war. In this particular case that I'm talking about, the Silicon Revolution, the drive to generate unbreakable codes for radio transmission on the part of the German forces generated the Enigma machine. And of course, in response to that, the more desperate drive to decipher those codes by British intelligence agencies produced a hothouse development of computer capability that cost sums of money that no peacetime capitalist agency, private or public, would have dared to spend. Alan Turing, the computer genius who killed himself because his homosexuality was unacceptable to the society which wanted his expertise, he and his colleagues at Bletchley advanced computer design into a new level of complexity and power. And it demanded a new technology, which it so happened was there waiting in the wings, solid-state electronics. The old thermionic valve, your push-pull systems and your diodes and triodes were replaced by transistors. But even transistors, this size as compared with the valve this size was still large and clumsy in comparison to today's microchips and assemblies, in which, on something about as big as half my fingernail, you have millions of transistors and resistors and capacitors. Might, as I said, seem like an exercise in futility, just getting things smaller and smaller. But in fact, small means a new dimension. Small means that you can stack thousands and thousands of things together, and you can have an impact on the problem of, like, the same sort of impact you can have if you get thousands and thousands of people working pieces of stone. They can do it. There are problems which are now perfectly capable of being solved because you can apply a computer to them, which were insoluble. It would have taken years for people to do it sitting at desks or even handheld calculators. And the modern computer, such as the one some of us have been looking at in the library there, now has the sort of organizational power and analyzing power and calculating power that a roomful of valves and circuitry at the end of the war, we're only talking about nearly 50 years ago, at the end of the war, such a room could not have done as much as your average personal computer can today. And it is not simply things like those we've been looking at, not those computers, which are having the impact. They're almost every piece of equipment, let me say electrically driven equipment, in the main, that we have these days has got a computer or a semi-automatic system inside it. Your average car has something like 3 or 4 mini computers in it, regulating the fuel, controlling the braking system, in some cases checking the tire pressures. We are generating a new type of machine. We're generating types of device and machine that are and have been and are still doing added work, millions of workers across the world. There are now millions of jobs that are being done by computers that used to be done by people at desks sometimes, like this, standing there writing. No longer necessary. Think of all the printers who've gone out of a job because it can now be done from a keyboard by somebody who's not a compositor, not a linotype operator, nothing like that. Those have gone. It's not only production machines, it's the control of power stations, traffic systems, motor car engines and braking systems I've mentioned, even your washing machine now has a little computer in it. Almost every device of any complexity that we use is being handed over to computers, simple or complex, small or large. Of course, somewhere down the line, often a long way down, a human being either built it or is still there maintaining it. Human beings, after all, have still got all the control of these things. But whereas at one time somebody would be in charge of a capstan lathe or about 4 automatics, people are now running whole factories. Individuals are now running the whole factory. Productivity hasn't simply doubled or trebled in these areas, as it used to do with the various mechanical automatic systems and the old automation. It's risen over 1,000-fold in many such production systems when we're talking about the extraction of surplus, the number of workers involved. And it's still got a long way to go because there is a long way for these machines to spread into everyday life. The car manufacturers are probably well up to the front of it. When you look at some of the more expensive cars and what is now being run by computers in the cars, you know, the ABS braking system, really, it's quite a marvel when you come to think of it. It's putting on and off the brakes hundreds of times a second to make sure that it never locks, to make sure that you're braking in a safe way. People still manage to crash them, of course, because they tend to rely on them. But that sort of thing is happening, and you're not being asked about it whether you wanted it mechanical, whether you wanted it computerized. It's being done. I suppose the one I mentioned before is a good example of this spreading of computers into everything, and also a good example of the cheapening of commodities because of the improving technology. It's the memory chips in computers. Now I'm thinking of upgrading one, and I've left it for a long, long time because memory has been relatively dear. Memory comes on chip holders, which are about that big. The little fingernail is stuck in the middle of them. All the rest is to enlarge it to a size so that you're capable of plugging it in with your fingers, otherwise you couldn't pick it up. Now, 10 years ago, 10 megabytes cost about 100 quid. 5 years ago, thieves still found it worth their while to break into offices, open up the computers and take their memory chips out because they're worth more than their weight in gold. Now, it's a quid a megabyte. A million bytes of memory for a pound. How's that come about? Well, it's come about because capitalists have invested hundreds of millions of pounds in memory production. They are the most sophisticated factories that we have ever seen on Earth. Such workers as there are in there are dressed in surgical clothes, and the place is cleaner than any operating theatre in any hospital. There must not be a single speck of dust in the atmosphere, because a speck of dust will ruin a chip. We are down now to molecular level in the sizes that they are machining to and the size that they are designing them to. And they are near to the limit because it will soon be down towards atomic level. What they have done, therefore, is move the capital round again, reinvested to make more and more highly sophisticated products. And such production is almost totally automated, totally computer controlled. Now, capitalist economists could have seen this sort of thing happen, but it seems to come on them and create despair in them. But this is precisely what Marx predicted over 100 years ago. He told them that this sort of thing happens. Do you know these memory things, to just revert to for a moment, you get something out like Micromart or Computer Shopper, and you get a list of the prices, various terms, quote you the list of the prices. Up against the memory chips, they'll say ring for a quote. In other words, this thing comes out every week and that's not fast enough to adjust our prices. You ring and ask us how much. The same is true of central processing units, which are somewhat bigger and considerably more expensive. But ring for a quote because the prices ought to be so fast. Anyway, what we're talking about here, or what I'm talking about, is components that can be picked up or fitted together, even if they are brains of a sort. They're only half the phenomenon of the Silicon Revolution. Brains are useless without thinking processes and the thoughts that make brains useful. In the jargon of the trade, the hardware is no good without the software. So alongside companies like International Business Machines, IBM, Motorola, and Intel, who produce computers and chips, other companies producing computer programs have grown up at a prodigious speed. Particularly, everybody has heard now of the richest man in the world, the richest man of all time. Who is he? Bill Gates, the Microsoft Corporation. His capital in that, as they can estimate it at the moment, is worth $50 billion. No, not million, billion dollars. Of course, a stock market crash could wipe out a large fraction of that overnight. Capitals like that. But not only Gates, but quite a large cohort of directors on that firm have made multi-millions themselves. And they've made it in quite a few years, since the 70s, in fact. The rate of accumulation of capital has been stupendous. And yet Microsoft have got no factories as such. They've not even got a product like a computer disk. It's the software printed on them, just in the same sort of way as music is printed on CDs, and CDs are used to print it, just like words and pictures are printed in books. Well, we're familiar with this sort of thing. Books with fiction, books with advice, books with information have all been quite common since books were first invented. The difference with the computer programs which constitute the software is this, that it is actually active. It intervenes in the real world. It guides machine systems, these thought processes which are on the disks. It controls. It is, in one of the other pieces of jargon at the time, smart. So you can even have a smart card with a chip in it. What they've done, therefore, with software is bridge the gap between information and action so that these days these devices, for example, in the home, take the place of servants. They wash your clothes for you. You tell it what you want, you tell it what sort of washing, it does it for you. Put the dishes in the dishwashing machine, set the program, set it up. You put the flour, the water and the yeast and the sugar and whatever other ingredients go into making bread. Into the bread machine, you shut it down, you set the time that you want it for, and at that time your loaf of bread is there and the bell rings and you go and take it out. But it also, with these things, much of the drudgery in writing letters, keeping accounts, accessing information in case of a personal computer, all of that is again a servant's type of job. It's much simpler to do many of these things, these communicating things that we used to do. And in industry, computers have in a way become another stratum of worker. A stratum of worker that's already instructed in the complex tasks that we're asking it to perform, almost as though they were instinctive. They're capable of making decisions not only about which tool to feed in to cut or grind the metal, but making management decisions, making medical diagnoses, making stock market dealing decisions, and so on and so on. These are particular types of programs with decision making. Take another branch, drawing offices. I don't know, amongst the older of us, those who remember friends of ours at school who said, yeah, I'm going to train to be a draftsman, I'm going to a drawing office. And you could have a drawing office as long as from here to the other end of the college, and I've seen them with rows of draftsmen at huge drawing boards, all each with their little light, all the drawings for factory production. Gosh. One or two such people sitting at computers with computer-aided design programs are producing far more drawings of far greater complexity than, and also in many cases producing machining instructions on disk for the processes, the production processes that go on. Rows of workers gone. Unlike automation, or the principle of automation was using error and the amount of error to correct error or to modify the error, to modify the system. Computerization isn't like that. It's not confined to the process or system. Computerization can introduce new parameters and new instructions, and what is much more important, computers can learn from experience, and they can become increasingly effective, increasingly efficient. Above all, compared with automation, computerization is cheap. Very cheap. One time, all the software for production processes and so on had to be particularly put in by specialised firms. There's so much off-the-shelf software now which only needs adapting that most of the processes which we can think of have already been encompassed by these programs. The general point I'm making is that this new layer of semi-intelligent machinery has multiplied the rate of surplus value extracted from a large range of workers in quite a sudden large boost over the last few years. And that rate of change is likely to go down. It cannot keep going on at that rate. But what has happened is that capitalism has moved up a notch. It's moved into a higher gear. From now on, most of our machines will become smart. They will know what tasks to perform and how to perform. All we shall need to do is trigger them, give them some sort of instruction, like phone, and it will come on, and we shall be able to talk to somebody. Or lights, and that sort of thing will happen. Doesn't need to be a voice command, it can be a pressing a button, whatever. But that's the principle that's operating. Now, for a socialist world, and for removing drudgery, that would be an enormous boon. We don't need to do these nasty, tedious little jobs. For capitalism, however, it's providing yet more of an embarrassment of riches. And it's going to increase and sustain the scourge of unemployment for years to come. Moreover, the scarcity that all markets depend upon, the scarcity which provides the excuse for keeping workers working hard, workers consuming only just enough to carry them on to the next payday, that's going to have to be imposed much more oppressively as it becomes more obviously absurd. And we're touching on some of the earlier discussion here. What's got to happen increasingly, and we touched on this in the last talk, I didn't expect it, more wasteful consumption. It's got to go on if these products are going to go somewhere. There have got to be more pointless pursuits, sports of all sorts, leisure pursuits of all sorts, more helter-skelter rides, bigger rides, all the rest of it. More organised leisure, like centre parks and Butlins holiday camp type things. More expensive luxuries that have got to be hyped and heralded as though they were necessities. All that has got to go on in capitalism because they have got to maintain the myth that human wants are insatiable. That's what capitalism has always contended. No productive potential could ever satisfy everyone, the defenders of capitalism will tell you. So they're going to have more surveillance systems, more control procedures, all of that to make sure that men and women of the working class and the children do only what they're allowed to do and go only where they're allowed to go. People mix some of their pages up here. And of course, the consequences of this are the more rapid depletion of waste resources, the more inevitable pollution of the planet with the rubbish that this society generates with increasing quantity and toxicity. For Marx and for the analysis of capitalism he spent his life developing, all of this is the mixture as before. More massive, more complex, more threatening, more outrageous, but basically unchanged in the way it works. It's basically as it is now, just because of the way it has been working since he died 150 years ago. It's an inevitable progression from that. For him, of course, it was impossible to see exactly what types of technological and scientific developments would emerge from this frenetic pursuit of profit. But he knew far better than anyone else of his time that the institutionalized avarice and paranoia of this system, which was still then being established, would change the face of the earth, the nature of work, and the relationship of human beings towards one another, and towards the actual planet they lived upon. And it's because of this breadth of vision, and this scientific open-mindedness, that we value his contribution so much.